This is Femi Kuti, and you are listening to NYC Radio Live.
All right, how you doing, folks? David Ellenbogen here. Great to be with you. I got to hang with Martha Redbone, the great singer, composer, activist. I'm sure I'm leaving out a few important parts of her multifaceted being, but I'm in a rush. she's going to be performing this Friday, actually, and at the David Rubenstein Atrium, for a series produced by the India Center Foundation, Brooklyn Raga Massive, and Lincoln Center called Outside India. And yeah, I had the thrill of talking with her. But she also said we can share this beautiful album that she has called The Garden of Love, Songs of William Blake. So let's start out with one, and then we get to hang out with Martha Redbone. Enjoy, and thanks for listening.
I'm
All right. I am here with Martha Redbone. Really great to be with her. I'm the cusp of a big show at Lincoln Center this Friday in the David Rubenstein Atrium. And it's a collaboration with Brooklyn Ragamuffin. So thanks for taking the time to hang out.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, David.
Yeah, good to be with you. So we don't have a ton of time, but I'd love to kind of get the story. I mean, it seems like music came really early in your life.
In my life?
Yeah.
I guess so. But professionally, I would say, you know, that came in my 20s.
Oh, really?
You know, I think that music is in everybody's life, you know, at
sure.
a young age. But I think the turn from having it become a natural influence in your life to making it a career, you uh-huh. know, a profession is different. But so I would say in my 20s,
something
snapped. Yeah. Well, what happened was I wanted to write songs, and I had already been discovered and invited to sing on several recordings as a background vocalist. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I was pretty good at doing that and did a lot of sessions in London, England. But I really had this calling for wanting to tell stories, you know, and write songs. And I love melody, you know, having grown up in Kentucky and, you know, in Appalachia and those sounds. So melody is something that's very strong. That's the kind of defining line that goes right through any particular style. For me, it's usually a strong melody and then a really great story. So I decided to become a songwriter, you know, a lyricist. Mm-hmm. And I began working with several producers and putting things together. And then in that time, through a mutual friend, I met my partner, Aaron Whitby, who is a fantastic musician, pianist, and producer. And so we made the perfect kind of combination. We had a great fit, and we covered such a vast music vocabulary between the two of us. We could write just about anything for anyone. Mm. And so we very quickly became a songwriting team, writing songs for myself, and then some songs that we wrote, sometimes for the sake of writing, we ended up being able to place them with other artists. And from there we became this duo, the dynamic duo, and got a publishing deal and became kind of in-house kind of staff.
Wow.
Songwriters, old school style.
Yeah,
you know?
You don't hear that
so
much
we
anymore.
We did that, yeah, and we did. You know, there were loads of us, you know, in England and also here in the States, who basically, you know, write songs for other, you know, pop mm-hmm. artists and international artists and things. And
this
so
was like in the 80s.
This was
thing?
In the 90s.
In the 90s. So it's still happening in the 90s.
Oh,
that
absolutely. This is more like the late 90s.
Okay.
And just as a lot of those companies were kind of emerging and mm-hmm. becoming new things. So that was an interesting time for music in general, as a music styles were emerging. We had people were figuring out ways to make the hip hop beats and apply those to all different other genres, and a lot of kind of hybrids forms of pop songwriting, so to speak.
And any notable like songs that we might, or artists that we might know of?
Most of them were international artists. Most of them were artists in Canada. There was a I don't even remember. There was a British artist called Shola Ama, and she's a British. She won like many mm-hmm. British music awards, equivalents
right.
to, you know, I guess British Grammys, I guess.
Right.
And then there was another pop artist who came out of France, and then someone in Canada It's very hard to remember. There's so many, right, you know, that we wrote for. Right.
So anyway, yeah, so you're starting to get these big, long checks, the publishing checks.
Kind of, sort of. Okay. You know, but not, you know, but, not as big as we would, okay, like. But,
well, I meant actually they're just the size. So usually
exactly. But not the zeros.
Physically big. Yeah. So.
But one of the things that I'd like to mention is part of our music journey and production values journey that Aaron and I really attribute to was being mentored by Junie Morrison from Parliament Funkadelic,
oh, right,
who was a huge influence for us in our early stages of, you know, honing our skills and our studio styles, you know, and techniques,
yeah,
and things like that. And Junie was living in London at the time and when we met, and he mentored us, and we ended up performing on the Mothership Reunion record.
Nice.
You know, for George. And that was really amazing, yeah, just being a part of that whole process. And in the world of, you know, being a junior Funkadelic.
Sure.
So that was really great fun.
Can you, were there any like specific kind of songwriting lessons or production techniques that you could like think of, like little bits of wisdom that he kind of passed along?
Oh, absolutely. He said, one of the things that he said was, you will probably have the most success with your least favorite song. And then the other things that he's also said was, he said you would probably have the most success with your least favorite song. Something that you really absolutely hate about something that you've written will probably be the most popular.
Wow. That probably applies like across
to
the board.
Many, the to irony, you, the irony of success, right, I guess, in music.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're one of the beautiful things about, you know, being mentored by the folks in Parliament Funkadelic is that anything goes. You know, these are genius musicians, masters at their craft.
Sure.
Master singers and mm-hmm. players, you know, of every instrument, you know, because they came from the era where you had to be not just good at something, but everybody got an instrument and you excelled.
Yeah.
It. And these were, you know, people from the Midwest, you know, and the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a wonderful thing to be in an environment where if you heard a melody that sounded like the blues or country or rock and roll, you know, that it was okay. And if you wanted mm-hmm. to sing with a, you know, like a kind of heavy metal rock voice, that was fine. That worked as well,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then, you know, the stories that you could tell could be funny, you know,
right.
Love could be funny. Love songs could be hilarious, you know, or a perspective about one particular thing. Like, you know, I want to use, you know, not just knee deep, you know, it's about dancing, but the way that they, you know, visualize it. And how they put it into words and what you're, you know, what you're looking for. It's just such an interesting and I think genius way of basically writing a song about having a lot of fun.
So do you think,
they play with words a lot.
Yeah,
that's what I was getting at.
Yeah. Do you think that from your like inside perspective that the big contribution of Parliament Funkadelic was this wide openness kind of thing? Like,
absolutely. I think I kind of compare it, and I often imagine, you know, if Jimi Hendrix were alive, you mm-hmm. know, were still alive, I mean, he would fit right in, because I think the hybrid crossover was Jimi Hendrix, and then I think from there, you know, George Clinton and all those guys, you know, it was the days of free love, you know, when mm-hmm. when these different styles were all together. I mean, you can hear Crosby, Stills and Nash in their music, and I hear P-Funk in Crosby, Stills and Nash. I hear those
right.
harmonies and those arrangements. You can hear all of these styles cross over into each other during that time. I think that was a really beautiful time of music, and, you know, we're really very lucky to have that era, you know, recorded and available.
Yeah, and it's not even just the music. I mean, it's almost the way things sounded, the way the instruments sounded, the way things recording sounded. Like, it seems like that in a thousand years, they'll be listening to the 1970s and
60s. There was a magical time when a lot of things fell into place, and a lot of different styles had already existed by then. And I think that putting them together was a new form of what I call folk music, you know, because it came from all folk, you know?
Right. So, well, that's an interesting tie into your music, because I feel like you seem like an artist that doesn't particularly want to be constrained by the genre police, right? You know? And I don't know, I guess we could take it from there. So this happened, and you had this super inspirational period, and you're writing songs, and then when do you make the leap that you say?
I think that beginning phase, you know, the beginning of our professional music career, and I'm speaking for Aaron, because the music comes from both of us. It's a real team, a true team. And it's been a team for 25 years, you know. So I do believe that the experience of being mentored by Junie Morrison from Parliament Funkadelic, one thing that it taught us is that whatever you do is acceptable, you know.
Right.
That there are no rules. And if there's a rule, it's meant to be broken. You know, you're meant to, it's art. It's art and it's creation. So they showed us and proved to the world that there are no boundaries when it comes to art.
Right.
And we must remember that as the creative person, you know, that there are no boundaries when you're experimenting, when you're discovering art. Otherwise, if you set all these boundaries, then we don't grow, and then we might as well just copy the next thing.
Right.
And I think that that's, you know, that it's almost like it's an inhuman form to place boundaries on things, and categorizing is not really the job of the artist, of the musician. That's not our job. There are people who get paid lots of money to figure out ways to market and sell these things, but it's not our job to even think about it.
Right.
You know, because once we start thinking about it, then we start limiting ourselves, and that's what you don't want to do.
I rose up at the dawn of the day. Get thee away.
Get thee away.
Get thee away.
Get thee away.
Praise thou for riches. Away, away. This is the throne of Mammon great. Said I, this sure is very odd. I took it to be the throne of God. For everything besides I have, it is only for riches that I can crave. I have mental joy and mental health and mental friends and mental wealth. I've a wife I love and that loves me. I have all but riches bodily. I am in God's presence night and day, and he never turns his face away. The accuser of sins by my side doth stand, and he holds my money bag in his hand. For my worldly things, God makes him pay, and he'd pay for more if to him I would pray. And so you may do
Indian classical rag, is that, was that something on your plate of listening to? And
it's funny that you say that, but about a year ago, a bit over a year ago, I discovered some beautiful classical music, Indian music from India, and it was on YouTube. And the sounds, it stopped me in my tracks because it sounded like slide guitar from Appalachia. Mm. And I was completely blown away by it. And I saved the link. And I just saved it in my computer. And then, you know, a year and a half later, we got a call from Samir, who said, who asked, invited us to perform in this series that he created called Outside India. And we talked about combining our styles, you know, with the mountain music of India meets the mountain music of America.
Right.
And it immediately just brought me back to that that YouTube link that I found.
Right.
Which I had in my phone. And so, of course, we jumped at the chance to do something like that. And we thought, well, you know, outside India, and India and Indian as an American Indian and Native American. And this is something that we've never done before with classical Indian music. We've never done this before. I have always wanted to do it. I just never knew how to go about doing it. And but we have been experimenting with other particular, you know, other styles of music. But this is going to be absolutely magical. I mean, we just came from rehearsal and we're buzzing. I have so many sounds in my head, in my mind. It's kind of hard for me to even talk properly because it's going to be so exciting.
Wow.
It was just a beautiful experience. I knew it would be, and it surpassed my imagination.
Good.
So I'm very, very excited about Friday.
Yeah. You know, hearing your voice, I mean, it's like really obvious that there's some strong rootedness in gospel tradition and this kind of thing. And to me, gospel music, just the way that someone like Mahalia Jackson sings, it's like it's inherently, I don't know if the word is rebellious, but maybe it is. It's so assertive that it seems,
it's arresting.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I wonder what
I
your
do,
take
I
is
think,
on that.
I do. I agree with that. And also there's a, what's the word? A kind of tautness. In that style of singing, and it's I also kind of equate that gospel style of singing with traditional Native American singing as well, you know, with the vocables that we sing, which we are also combining in this music on Friday. You feel a great similarity between the, you know, gospel and traditional Native American vocable style. Absolutely.
Maybe you can enlighten me. Someone was just telling me a documentary came out about kind of the Native American influence on the blues. And I think it was, might have been Son House or one of these guys had Native American roots, and that a lot of actually certain songs and parts of the idiom actually have Native American roots.
Almost everything.
Yeah.
I mean, when this is American music, mm-hmm. and before anyone else came, this was the sound of America.
Yeah.
And so that has to be the foundation from where everything else must be built upon. And so when you hear it in blues, there's also a book called Indian Blues by John Troutman, and which talks about this influence on blues, about the Native influence on the blues. But particularly in the Southeast, where my family's from, because we're Cherokee, Choctaw, Shawnee, and African American, and you can hear it in the melodies. You can hear you can hear it in the prayers, you know, that the traditional prayers. You can hear it in all the stomp songs, the traditional stomp songs, and the repetition that you hear, you know, from the dances that we do, that repetition, you hear that in the blues as well. So if, you know, someone comes from Africa and brings the banjo from Africa and plays that melody line, ding 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 ding. You know, you can hear that on the guitar, on the banjo, and you'll hear you know, someone sing, you know, we got beans, cornbread, you know, you can hear that. And then you'll also hear the Choctaw people sing something, you know, similar to that, you know, it's exactly the same. And you can hear, I'm just giving you a quick, speedy example.
Yeah.
Of a Southeastern stomp, but you hear the line all the way from the beginning on all of it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, and I guess it's kind of a history that's not as highlighted, the African American and Native American like relationships.
You know, yeah, I think it wasn't highlighted, because if it were highlighted in a big way, then colonialism might have not happened.
Right.
So, of course, you know, these groups of people will be downplayed, you know, as actually being together and being communities that helped each other. Yeah. So that's how you conquer new lands, you know, right, by saying particular things don't exist and wiping them away on paper. So.
Yeah. So you got this thing coming up Friday. You have some other big things in the works? Or?
Yes, we have. We're developing a musical, and we've been doing many different iterations of it, and working with the Public Theater, which has been so much fun.
Great.
And talking about a family story, which involves Native and African American lineage and family members. So based on my family back home, we also have, in the beginning of May, we have a series of concerts for New York City schools as part of Carnegie Hall's Musical Explorers.
All right, yeah.
So we have been working with singing traditional Southeastern Native American music, teaching that to children. We also have, we're going out to California at the end of April, to Lubbock, Texas. So we're around. We have our website that, and also social media.
Sure.
To keep in touch with where we'll be.
Nice. Yeah, and I mean, sometimes I end up on the periphery of certain Native American events and this kind of thing. And it seems like there's been a little bit of a movement where Native Americans, like a kind of pan-tribal kind of situation, where there's a lot more maybe consolidation between, you know, is that something that you've noticed? Is that?
Yeah, I think that kind of pan Native American culture, in a way, maybe it's happening by default.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think it has a lot to do with organizations that are forming to have, you know, festivals and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have, you know, 573 federally recognized tribes with, you know, all different languages and dialects and different cultures and lifestyles. And I think that, you know, it's, I think if people can have access to a little bit of what each of us is about, each group is about, and each family story, if we're allowed to share our individual family stories, I think that's the best way of keeping us and acknowledging us for who we are, you know, rather than kind of lumping us in to this kind of pan
right.
thing. I tend to think that sometimes I find that, you know, American culture tends to try to lump people in
mm-hmm.
without looking at the individual. You know, we're just all people. All people are this or all people are that, this group.
Sure.
And it's, you know, I think it's really, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. It's not the way to learn about who we are and learn about each of us individually, because we all each have so much to offer. I mean, you can't, you know, take a country like India and say that everyone is just in, you know what I mean?
Sure.
There's so many different styles of music and styles of, you know, food and language. Sure. And there's so many things. It's such a huge difference from the North to the South culture. Mm-hmm. It's like, how can you just lump it all? How can anyone just lump that in and say, that's what this is?
Yeah.
It's only one part of it. And so my hope is, by sharing my family story, I can help redefine these kind of pan epidemics mm-hmm. that are happening with
right.
regard to culture. Because I think that as humans, we deserve better than that, you know, than to just be generalized and closed off, because there's so many, this is the 21st century, you know, we know better
right.
now. You know, we should know better, and we do know better. And, you know, there's social media and the internet and computers and research. Everything is at our fingertips these days. We can find just about anything that we need to discover on the computer. And if we don't see it on the computer, we can ask someone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that's the best way to learn. Yeah, that's the best way to learn about who we are. There's a big difference between, you know, people from Choctaw and people from, you know, Tohono O'odham,
mm-hmm.
you know, or Chickasaw and Chinook. You know, it's a huge mm-hmm. difference. And I think if we took the time to learn and even pronounce our names, I saw something that was really fantastic on the internet. Yesterday, there was an actress from Orange is the New Black, and she has a very, her name is Uzumaka, something like that. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. And she said that she hated her name. She grew up in Boston in a Nigerian family. Her name is Uzumaka. And so when she was a little girl, she said to her mother, Mama, can you name me? I want to be called Zoe. And she said, why? She said, because people don't know how to pronounce my name. I've been called as Imoka, as Mika, Uzuzuka, all of this. Mm. She said, it's just easier for people to call me Zoe, if I'm called Zoe. And she said, her mother said, if they can learn to pronounce Dostoevsky, Tchaikovsky, you know, and all of these names, they can certainly learn to pronounce Uzumaki, you know. And that's how I feel about all of our names, of where we come from and who we are. People can take the time to learn who we are. We deserve that respect as humans.
Yeah, and you know, as you're talking, I'm feeling how it's like the world is made up of story, and it's made up of language, you know, and that's almost all, that's like if we were fish, that's the water that we live in,
right?
You know,
right? And we just have to take the time to learn it and respect it, you know, and each other, and I think we'll be fine.
I think we'll be okay. So, yeah. All right. Well, on that hopeful note, I guess we'll see you on Friday. And hopefully, I guess maybe there'll be some music. You'll have some music I can share on the podcast.
Sure. Yes. Yeah, okay. We can. From Friday show, we have some of our recordings we can send for sure.
The thing that I've heard is the William Blake album. Which
yes,
really
okay. So that you have that. That's our latest physically available one.
I had a funny experience with William Blake. My grandparents had one of his famous paintings. I'm sure you can think of it. It's probably like the most famous painting, a reproduction of that one, where there's an old man and he's like reaching down and there's kind of a pyramid of light coming out. And when I was little, they had to take that off the wall because it like scared me. Yeah.
Wow.
So I guess there was something super fundamental in his thing that must have hit you in the chest, right?
Yeah, I think, Aaron is the one who found rediscovered the book on our shelves. And we just really love the language. We absolutely fell in love with the language and the you forget how beautiful the English language can be. You know, there's so many ways of painting a picture with words, and me being a lyricist, you know, we have lots of poetry because I love the play on words. I love the way words sound. I'm a singer.
Right.
There are particular words that do not sing well. You know, the poems that we chose of William Blake's were, he originally wrote them as songs. So
yeah, okay.
These particular stanzas, you know, make sense. They sing very well. It just, it was such an easy organic flow to make these settings for them.
And it works with that feel. It's really
was
great.
Really lovely. And also John McEwen, who produced it with us, who made some beautiful arrangements of it too. But the way that we wrote these songs were, and we wanted to stay true to the form that Blake wrote them in, so we sing them straight down as the way he wrote them, and then we only repeat them at the end to keep the integrity of the poem. We didn't switch things around or anything.
Right.
It's a great fun project to do.
Yeah, a treasure trove.
Mm.
Yeah, I was trying to describe him to my girlfriend. I was like, well, he's kind of like a mystic, right? I mean, there's
kind of, but I find that the poems that we chose were really, the messages were very relevant to modern times. I mean, these are poems that are over 250 years old, but he's still talking about, his longing for people to have compassion, compassion and have mercy for people, you know, and when someone is suffering, you know, have pity. The word pity changed its definition since the original thing when someone is pitiful, you're meant to show mercy. But the word pitiful means something different these days. It almost, I think people are confusing the word pitiful with pathetic.
Right. Pharaoh's hardened our hearts.
Yeah. And yeah, I think the language and how he, I found a couple of the poems that we found were really almost a Buddhist philosophy.
Right.
You know, of when you see someone suffering, you know, you it's your responsibility as a human to help, you know, in some way. And how can you not help?
Right.
You know, and yes, you may be suffering yourself, but to know that another person is suffering, that empathy there is what I felt. Well, this is something that the world needs to be reminded of again. So we chose poems that spoke to us that way, and also painted the imagery for us of Appalachia, of what the mountains meant to us, and also things about religion, you know, being part of the kind of Bible Belt, you know, in Kentucky, and those mountains there, and what that language might have been like for people who, you know, went to church in 1880.
So when you go back home, how does your music resonate?
It's great. I mean, we just came back from Kentucky. We had a wonderful concert in Louisville with Ben Solee. We had a double bill, and that was a really fantastic project. Another one where we put our two bands together and learned each other's songs.
Oh, cool.
And then wrote a song together and then performed that for the audience and told Kentucky stories. We're Kentucky natives, so that was really great fun.
Wow. Mm. All right. Well, I don't want to get in the way if you're, you have some fun in Chinatown coming up. So. Good. All right. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you, David. I can't wait
for Friday. Thanks for all your music, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more great things coming up. So
yes, please do come. It's David Rubenstein Atrium.
Yeah.
It's 7:30. Come early. It's going to be packed.
An hour early. That's the
you
sad
do.
Thing. Yeah.
And but it's free.
Yeah.
And it is going to be amazing. It's a really beautiful room, and the best thing to do is come early, because I think it will be really packed on a Friday night. It'll be great fun. Looking forward to
it.
And I'm really thankful to Samir Gupta for his vision, and the India Center for helping make this happen.
And Brooklyn Raga Massive.
Yes.
And Lincoln Center, Mira Dugal.
All right.
Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
Told my wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not, my wrath did grow. And I Sunday. into my garden stove. When the night had veiled the pole, in the morning glad I see my pole outstretched in ye.